Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello, and welcome back. In today's episode, I'm excited to welcome Karen Delaney and Jennifer Judge. I'll introduce them individually, but you may know them collectively as the hosts of the smash hit, laugh out loud, success, Lawyers Behaving Badly podcast. Karen is the principal of Delaney Legal PLLC, where she provides general counsel, contract negotiation, employment law, and workplace misconduct investigation services to corporate clients. Before starting her own firm, which I hope we'll talk about on the episode, she worked in-house both at Half Price Books and GameStop and as an associate at a law firm in Dallas. Karen's a graduate of WashU Law, Go Bears, and UT Austin, Hook'em Horns, I think I got that right. And my other guest today is Jennifer Judge. Jennifer is the chief legal officer and general counsel at Destination Pet. Prior to her role at Destination Pet, she had her own law firm, where she functioned as an external GC to startup companies, and before that, worked as a GC at Rug Doctor, deputy GC at Caliber Home Loans, and also as a law firm associate. She's a graduate of Texas Law, once again, Hook'em Horns, and Emory University. Go Eagles. Thank you both for being here. I'm so excited you agreed to come tell your story on my show.
Thank you, Jonah.
Yeah, thank you, Jonah. We're excited.
Yeah, it's so fun to get to do this with people who I feel like I've been like following from afar. It's one of those fun things about the sort of social media legal podcasting world. It's a very small group, but once you get to hang out with those people, you realize how much you actually have in common, even if jobs and distances and everything else are not what you'd normally find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it makes the world pretty small when you look at these communities.
Exactly, exactly. The internet makes the world big, but it lets you create these really small niches, which is sweet. But look, let's start by talking a little bit about how you both became lawyers before we get to hear about your lives as general counsels, whatever that is, and associates and everything else, and podcasters. So maybe we could start with Karen. Tell me a little bit about sort of your path to becoming a lawyer. What made you decide to join the profession? What kind of lawyer do you think you were going to be when you started?
I think I have a pretty typical story, which is I had limited exposure to careers generally, I think, growing up, because my dad was an engineer at Texas Instruments. My mom was a technical editor at Raytheon, and I wasn't quite sure what technical editing was, but I was pretty certain I didn't want to do it. And I knew that engineering was not for me because the way that my brain simply works is more oriented towards words and language, not physics and math and all that stuff. And so I, in spite of that self-assessment, started out in college as a pre-med major, of course. I mean, it's just so typical, right? Like right. I started out pre-med and then I ended up going to law school. And at some point on my journey of self-discovery as a pre-med undergrad determined that I actually am terrible at chemistry and I didn't think I had the right skill set to be a doctor. And I thought that being a lawyer was probably a good match in terms of skill set. I've always been a strong writer and very analytical when it comes to language and the written word. And I thought that that would be a good match for me. And as far as what sort of lawyer I thought I would become, again, I had this very narrow, unexposed view of what the law was. And I knew there were lawyers who did contracts and I knew there were lawyers who were in court. And I wanted to be a lawyer who was in court because I thought doing contracts sounded extremely boring, which is very ironic given what I do now.
I was just going to say, I expected you to say the opposite of what you said just now. And that's it's fascinating. But look, I know you say it's normal or sort of a fairly common path, but actually I think it's so important for people to hear the stories of like the misstarts and not knowing what's going on, and also being able to look in the mirror and say like, what am I good at? Because I'm going to have to do it every day. Like, I just think that's such a valuable reminder to people who are figuring out what they want to do in the world.
Yeah, it sort of seemed like the choice was I could do really poorly in medical school or pretty well in law school. And I prefer to do well at things. So.
But it's so funny because that seem when you put it like that, and you guys are so much funnier than I am, which I love. Like when you put it like that, it seems so almost absurd. Like, why would you do something you're not good at? But how many people get stuck spending so much time in their life and they're like, man, I'm really not good at this. And when they look in the mirror, they should have known they were not going to be good at it when it began. And so that's part of like why I'm here for the legal profession is trying to tell people, here's what's potentially out there. So if you can find something that's a natural fit for you, like go find it. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, talk to me a little bit about your start.
Yeah, mine is not that dissimilar from Karen's other than I knew I never wanted to see blood. So pre-med wasn't in the cards for me.
Seems reasonable.
But I, you know, growing up, I loved reading, I loved writing, and I was very detail oriented and analytical. And, you know, it was one of those things where everyone tells you, you should be a lawyer when you grow up. So that is kind of what I realized, like, maybe I should be a lawyer. And then in retrospect, looking at like some wildly undiagnosed ADHD tendencies that kind of led me to law school, I worked in college at Ford and Harrison in the file room. And I realized then that I wanted to be an employment lawyer because it was interesting. You were dealing with interesting scenarios. Employment lawyers always have the best war stories at cocktail parties. And it kind of combined interesting stories, helping people when people make bad decisions, and then also same thing. I knew I wanted to be in court. I didn't know exactly what that was, but I knew I wanted to do it. And so I decided I wanted to do employment law when I graduated law school. And that was kind of my goal. It was a journey of self-discovery, same as Karen. And then, you know, a little bit of false starts and stops kind of as you go along. And in our case, in our generation, kind of as the economy changed, right, as we were baby lawyers as well.
Yeah. And before we get into sort of what you both have done and also sort of your different types of stops along the way, which I'd love to talk about, you both mentioned really wanting to be in court. And now both of you in your day-to-day practice are very much corporate facing. Can you talk to me a little bit about sort of what made you think you wanted to be in court and why you're not spending as much time there as you might have imagined when you were starting off?
Well, I think part of it is just the media portrayal of what lawyers do is largely focused on courtroom practice. And I didn't have any entry point into the law in my personal life. I'm the only lawyer in my family. We didn't know any lawyers. We didn't socialize with any lawyers. I wouldn't have even known what questions to ask a lawyer, even in law school, about practice and how to figure out what sort of practice I wanted and what was out there. But again, my very simplistic understanding was contracts versus being in a courtroom. And being in a courtroom sounded much more exciting to me than working on contracts stuck in your office all day. And I think the practice of law has changed so dramatically, even since I started, but certainly since the partners that I worked for as a young associate started, because when they initially started practicing litigation, you couldn't wait until midnight to file things with the federal courts. The court closed at 5 and your filings needed to be in the Dropbox if you were going to do it by then or to get files stamped by then. They didn't have email for a long time. They had word processing departments because none of them knew how to type, or they had a secretarial pool that performed all of that work. And I don't doubt that a number of them worked very hard and worked for long hours, but there's been an increase in sort of this frenetic pace of the practice of law. And I expect that transactional practices have seen this as well, because they're also susceptible to the same technological changes that litigation practices are. But the litigation practice area at this point is wildly unpredictable in terms of your schedule. You can be completely derailed by an irrational jerk on the other side. And that's not something I was familiar with before I started doing it as a junior associate.
Yeah, I would echo the exact same thing. I was the first lawyer in my immediate and extended family. We didn't have family friends who were lawyers. I had seen law things on the news and sitcoms, and I knew that looked interesting. So I decided that's what I wanted to do. And then I realized being in court is fun, and I did second chair several jury trials, and I did the Loan a Lawyer program with the city of Dallas and prosecuted misdemeanors, although I became infamous because I actually dismissed more than I prosecuted as like a little bit of civil disobedience.
Wait, so I would have... That surprises me so much that you engaged in a little bit of lawyerly civil disobedience.
I would have defense attorneys from other courts come over just for me to dismiss their claims. So nice. I became a little bit infamous there. But, you know, I had jury trials there where I was the only lawyer on them. And it was fun, but you also realize it is so rare in the practice of law at large and regional law firms to actually be in court mm-hmm. that the joy you get from being in court can't be offset by the grind and minutiae of the day-to-day of the practice of law in a law firm like that, for me, at least.
Well, it's true, too, about the amount of time that you spend in court, because whereas you actually got courtroom experience, I mean, I handled hearings and things, mm-hmm. but I was at the law firm that Jennifer and I started out at for 5 years. I had one case that went to trial during that time, one case. And it was when I was a first year associate. I think I had been there for maybe 6 months. It was out of town. And so I stayed back at the ranch, so to speak, while everybody else went off to trial because I was relatively new on the case. And mm-hmm. I wish in retrospect that I had raised my hand and said, hey, can I go? I won't bill for it. I just would like to be there and sit in on the proceedings. But none of the rest of my cases actually went to trial after that. So it's just such an incredibly rare experience these days, largely due to the insane costs that are associated with resolving disputes this way.
Mm-hmm. For better or for worse, too, you know, a lot of my practice when I was at Littler Mendelsohn was, you know, emergency injunctive relief, you know, enforcing non-competes or defending yourself from restrictive covenants, which led to TROs and emergency hearings, which again, are fun to be in court, but a TRO on a Friday is going to ruin your life and your schedule for the foreseeable future. And it's just, you add a couple of those into your mix. It's not conducive to a life that I wanted to lead for the rest of my life as a lawyer.
Totally.
Jonah, I really liked doing litigation, but I always tell people I think the reason for that is because I only did it for 5 years.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't worry. If anybody's listening to this and thinking, well, I need to stand up for litigation, there are plenty of litigators in my 125 episodes, and I teach legal writing for a living. So I am glad you're giving the other side of the story, and I think it's important.
We're here to trash litigation, Jonah.
No, that's
continue.
Fine. Exactly. No. But I do think being honest about what the practice and what the life is like and what the different ways to practice law is so, so important. And I think it's a really good point also that you raised, Karen, about like the law, the practice of law changes, right? Law is sort of a practice that happens as part of society. So as society changes, so too does law, right? I can't imagine not practicing law without email. Right. I mean, when my brother, who's not a lawyer, asked me, like, what did you do as an associate? My answer was, I write emails and I read other people's emails from 5 years ago. Like, that was my primary job. And it's so amazing to me that it's so different. And, you know, I just remember hearing stories like from people at my law firm who talked about, well, it used to be like you'd work on your brief in the morning by write it by hand, then you'd go play a round of golf while your secretary typed it up, and then you'd go read it, and then you'd go home and it would be FedEx to the client, which would take 2 days to get. Like, that's not how it happens anymore.
Yes.
And that's just such a big, big difference. Talk to me a little bit about sort of what it's like to actually, again, to use Karen's example of like you're either in court or doing contracts. Talk to me about what it's like to actually spend a lot of your day doing contracts. So for someone who's like seen Law and Order and Suits and said, okay, well, that's litigation. It's not. What does it really mean to be a corporate lawyer? And you guys have done it in a bunch of different formats. So I guess I'd just be curious about like what I'd see if I followed you around either today or maybe when you were just getting started in the more transactional practices.
I'll go first. And I'd say my in-house experience, I think, is slightly different than the vast majority of like how people get to in-house. You know, so much of in-house, because every company has contracts and every company needs someone to review those contracts. And so usually the easiest way to find your way in-house is doing, just like you said, contract review. I started in-house as a labor and employment lawyer. So my work was primarily in advising, you know, the human resources department on advice and counsel on employment issues. We were a 50-state employer. You have to, you know, abide by all the laws in all 50 states, obviously the federal laws. And there's a lot of complications that come with that. People are messy. You have complications that come with that. And then my roles subsequent to that have eventually grown into what I have now. So at this point, if I'm looking at a contract, it's probably a big one. And there's probably a not great reason that I'm looking at a contract at this point in time in my career. So it's kind of interesting because the other day, my husband, who is not a lawyer and works in IT and handles a lot of tech vendors, mentioned to me, God, I hate reviewing contracts. It's the worst. And I was like, me too. Like, that's the worst part of my job too. So I think it's very different because I know that Karen, that's her, she loves it, and more power to her. Because I think, you know, I tell people, I loved being in court. I loved arguing. One reason I'm so happy in-house is because you find a way to get that same thrill one way or the other that you get from being in court and litigating. And it could be arguing. It could be helping the business solve problems. It could be presenting to regulators. It could be something like that. And for some people, it's reading contracts and finding areas to improve in those and the language and the wording and things like that. So that may be teeing up Karen to kind of talk about her practice in-house and her contract review as well.
Well, my entry point to contracts was I left the law firm that Jennifer and I started at, and I joined GameStop as a corporate generalist. And at that time, the department there was made up entirely of corporate generalists, and it was extremely small for the size company that GameStop was. I think at that point, GameStop maybe had $11 or $12 billion in revenue, 6,500 locations worldwide, and 45,000 employees. And there were four or five of us in the legal department, and nobody was necessarily specialized in any particular thing. And it was expected that you would simply handle anything that walked in the door, and you might develop an expertise in a particular area by virtue of being the one to pick it up. So that's how I ended up, for example, helping to form and lead the cybersecurity incident response team at GameStop. I was the one who got that. But everybody was expected to handle contracts because as such a large organization, there's a large volume of contracts that come through the door. Think everything from software as a service to armored car services to telecommunications services that the company might need, HR consultants. I mean, really anything that a business needs to operate. And so my entry point was that to that was when I started at GameStop. And knowing that I was not a contract specialist, I had a call with our outside counsel on a Saturday morning. And I remember sitting in my apartment and we went through a contract line by line. And I literally got a contracts class from this outside counsel and then worked closely with him over the years that I was there to bounce questions off him or to ask things about best practices or how could I phrase this better? I'm struggling with this particular concept. And in a way, got sort of similar training to what you would get at a law firm because I had access to this partner who had been doing this for decades on demand to answer my questions. And he couldn't ignore me because I was the client.
Right.
So it was excellent training. And there was just such a high volume of contracts there. I had on my plate at any time 40 contracts, just depending on what was going on. And some of them were little and some of them were big, that all had to be kept moving and were all at sort of various points from inception to completion. And when I went to Half Price Books, that was also part of what I was responsible for because I was hired by a general counsel, but he ended up exiting several months after I joined and I took over the legal department as a legal department of one plus my paralegal and was responsible, obviously, for assessing risk in contracts. And I did a lot of that while I was there as well. And the reason I elected to focus on that is one of the areas that I spend quite a bit of my time on as a solo now is because I had a very specific objective in forming my solo practice and what I wanted it to look like. And part of what I wanted it to look like was to be fully virtual, to be able to take it anywhere and to work asynchronously. Huh. And that's something you can do with contracts a lot of the time. And that's that drove me even more into that practice area.
I mean, that leads me to the other question I was going to ask of both of you, because you've both done this kind of practice in a bunch of different areas, whether or sort of for a bunch of different types of legal organizations. And I guess, Karen, you started answering that question almost, but like, talk to me a little bit as if I knew nothing about the differences about doing the same kind of work, but in-house for a company and on your own.
At least in-house, I was the client and had significant external resources at my disposal that the company was willing to invest in the form of outside counsel to advise on issues, whether it's contracts or it's something related to HR, cybersecurity, or litigation, whatever it might be. I had those resources and had experts I could go to. And now as a solo, I am the expert and I rely more on primary resources like practical law or treatises, articles, things like that. And I have people that I can informally bounce questions off of. Jennifer is one of the main recipients of those questions. But not necessarily anybody who feels obligated to pick to answer the phone and answer my questions, right? And so I think that's one of the primary differences.
And do you like it?
I love being a solo. And this is the first time in my career that I could see myself doing this for the rest of my career. And I loved being in-house. I loved being a corporate generalist. I love solving problems. And I love being plugged in with the rest of the business to really understand the full universe of issues that the business is trying to confront and solve for. Whereas as external counsel, I get tiny little pieces. And very frequently, I have very little context for what I'm working on and where it fits within a client's priorities. But I love being self-directed. And I also love that there's a direct through line between the quality of my work and clients coming back to me, right? There's a lot of other noise in-house. And when you're in the corporate setting, in law firms too, you have other expectations, whether it's business development or it's social activities within the firm or other firm activities. And it's similar in a corporate setting as well. And a lot of people love that stuff and they're very motivated by it. I really, at the end of the day, I like doing high quality, interesting work. I'm not as necessarily motivated by some of the other corporate goodies, so to speak. So I love being a solo.
Yeah. And Jennifer, you've had paths in both. You had your own firm for a while. Now you're back in-house. Talk to me about sort of your take on what are the good parts about each? What are the differences? What are maybe some of the less good parts?
Yeah. I mean, I would echo a lot of what Karen said, but I would also, you know, my path to becoming a solo was driven in large part by Karen. I called her my solo Sherpa. Mm. So she's the one that kind of showed me how to do it. And just by way of backstory, I was at Caliber Home Loans for 7.5 years. They were sold to another company. So kind of assisted in that sale, the executive team turned over. And then I went to Rug Doctor, where I took the general counsel role. And 14 days after I started at Rug Doctor, where again, I was a law firm of me and a legal department of me and a paralegal, the CEO told me that our private equity backers had decided to sell us. So I spent 7 months at Rug Doctor, and my basically sole job was getting the company sold and then laying myself off. And so once I laid myself off, which was, I mean, again, that's what happens when you work for private equity companies, for better or for worse. It's kind of become my niche. And I talked to Karen, and she was thriving as a solo. And I set mine up. It's slightly different than hers. I functioned more as an external general counsel to smaller companies, startups, and assisted. I had a lot of contacts who had left the prior two companies I'd been at, had started their own smaller companies, couldn't afford full legal departments. So I kind of worked as their, you know, fractional general counsel. Mm-hmm. And I had absolutely no desire to go back in-house. I loved it. I loved being my own boss. And then one day, a mutual friend of Karen and I reached out with a potential job interview. And, you know, I said, listen, sure, I'll do it. And I actually spent days complaining to my husband about going to this job interview with the CEO for a chief legal officer position. I was like, you always take an interview, but this is a waste of time. I'm not going to do it. I'm not interested. And then I went and I met the CEO, who is now my boss, and was just so wowed by her and the company and wanted to sign up with her and work for her. And so the rest is history. I accepted that job. And I've been at Destination Pet since June. I have a legal department of 7. I have several lawyers and paralegals and the compliance department reporting to me. And so my job now is strategy and leadership for the most part. Hmm. So I lead a department. I work directly with the rest of our C-suite. I work with our board. Obviously, I manage litigation. But the vast majority of my role is being a leader so that the people below us in the organization can perform their jobs well. And that's kind of what my job is. So it's transitioned from a very hands-on tactical legal approach to, you know, professional development and empowering the lawyers and the paralegals who report to me.
Yeah. And I promise to anybody who's listening, just because they want to hear about the podcast, that's the next line of questioning. So I'm previewing it for you. If you're like on your lawnmower or in your car, it's coming. But a lot of the people who listen to this podcast and a lot of people who I work with are law students and junior lawyers, say in their first to third or fourth year of practice. And I remember when I was in that position, one of the challenges that I had, even at a law firm, having gone to a good law school, all of those things, was not having a good sense of how I could pitch myself to either go in-house or how I could think about myself. I don't think I would have been ready then, but think of myself as sort of being able to go out on my own. And so for those people, thinking back to all the different jobs that you've had and all the different sort of twists and turns, how do you recommend people who are still pretty early in their career, but looking to make that first pivot out of a law firm, either to work for themselves or for a company? What kind of recommendations would you give to those people?
Let's split those apart because those are two extremely different
Please.
Career paths. And I would say for anybody who's interested in going in-house, and especially if you were in law school and you've not already committed to developing a specific expertise, set up job searches now for in-house counsel and put a city with it. That's what I did for Indeed on Indeed.com. And start looking at the positions that frequently become available, because there are, for example, a lot of employment law positions. Mm-hmm. Companies always need employment counsel. A lot of companies outsource their litigation unless they're huge. So there's not always a demand for litigators. There's a lot of demand for M&A. And it's a very useful way of kind of monitoring the market real time to see where the demand is. And that'll tell you a little bit about what you might go into. And then as far as somebody who's looking to go out on their own, I started my solo practice in May 2020, although I didn't really kick things into gear until probably a year later, I think. But I was already fairly far along in my own career. I'd been at a law firm for 5 years. I was at GameStop for 6 years and Half Price Books for 3 and some change. So I already had quite a bit of experience. I think if I were fairly junior, I would be looking for who my mentors are going to be to provide me the guidance that I need, whether it's my actual client work, or if it's ethical questions, dealing with difficult clients, what should my tech stack look like? How do I invoice for this? Or, you know, there are just so many questions that come up that I feel like I already had a pretty good handle on because I had been in-house for so many years. I'd practiced in a large law firm and I had very well formulated opinions on what client service should look like and what I wanted my practice to look like. So I think you need to find your mentors, find your sponsors that you can ask those kinds of questions to when you're unsure. Because when you're that junior and you're only a few years out of law school, you're going to need guidance in order to make sure that you can do what you need to do and have the practice you want to have.
I would basically echo everything Karen said. And I think I'd also caveat that obviously my experience is going for as a solo to assist corporations and in-house with corporate problems. Obviously, you know, if you're looking at becoming a solo for family law or criminal defense or things like that, obviously the same, I would look for mentors, I would look for things like that. But Karen and I were both relatively far along in our career that we had had enough experience to know what it looks like to serve a client and what we prefer from outside counsel. So it gave us that knowledge to know how we would pitch our services to potential clients as well.
And to also know what I wanted to focus my practice area on, because I've seen a lot of comments by junior lawyers who are starting solo practices in one of the Facebook groups that we're a part of called Lawyer on the Beach, which I highly recommend for anybody who's looking to either start or continue a virtual practice or launch their own virtual practice. It's a great resource. But a lot of comments there from junior lawyers who are struggling to figure out what their niche is because they haven't been practicing long enough to really develop expertise in any particular area. And they think, oh, well, trust and estates is easy. I'll go do that. Well, trust and estates is actually one of the biggest generators of malpractice claims because it's a highly complex emotional area of law. And it's fine to get into these complicated areas, but I think you have to be humble enough to accept what you don't know and the fact that you are going to need help and to find somebody who's willing to guide you and to find appropriate resources.
I think that's such powerful advice. And I've heard different pieces of it on many of the other episodes that I've done, but never sort of as cleanly and clearly as the two of you laid out. What I think is really helpful there is I think a lot of junior lawyers and frankly law students, they're just so excited about making it big and doing something big, and they haven't yet had the experience yet. And so like one of the things that I've had other guests say, and I've sort of taken it as something that I try to teach to my students and people who listen is like, get the experience of wherever you are. You might not even like where you are, but at least get the experience from it. Like I hear you all talking about, well, I didn't know how to do this, but I was in a situation where I could learn how to do this, develop an opinion about how to do this. And at the same time, I love that advice of sort of keeping an eye out for what kinds of jobs people are looking for and using, whether it's LinkedIn or job boards. I think that's great advice.
And I would add, be open, just like you said. You may not be doing what you want to do, but you can gain experience from that. You may be working for a toxic boss. I've been there. Karen's been there. But you can learn how not to be a boss from that experience at the same time that you are desperately searching for a new job. And those experiences inform us later in our career. You may be practicing an area of law that seems not what you went to law school to do. It's not glamorous, but maybe that area of law is going to be what gets you your next job or gives you that marketable niche. So I would say just be open to the experience. Don't prejudge it and take what you can from whatever you're doing in the moment.
If you're unhappy with where you are and your job is terrible, milk that experience for all you can get out of it. Take what you can get. I mean, really, take what you can get while you can get it before you're able to move on, if you can. You know, and that can be really hard. I don't want to lose sight of the fact that that can be extremely difficult to do depending on the circumstances that you find yourself in if you're in a toxic work environment. But we provide services to law firms as associates. They're using us to some degree, and I highly encourage people to use those resources back.
Exactly. It's transactional. At the end of the day, it's transactional. And obviously, if you're unhappy, you should be looking for a new role. But don't waste the time that you're there. You know, use it to your advantage. Milk it for all it's worth.
And if you're in a great environment, but just looking for something else to do, those relationships are still going to be extremely valuable.
Exactly.
To nurture and to maintain.
Yeah, I think that's so right. And building that experience is invaluable. Whether you don't like where you are, or whether you like where you are, at the very least, if you're going to spend so many hours doing something, at least gain some experience, even if you don't know exactly how that experience or relationships are going to translate. You know, it's also hearing about how each of you found your niches and your paths by building relationships with people, but not always knowing exactly how those relationships were going to lead you to the next position, right? All right. So for everyone who was really waiting for the podcast story, I want to hear about lawyers behaving badly. I want to hear the origin story and how the two of you decided that two lawyers who spend a lot of times with their nose in contracts would be able to create such a hysterical podcast about crazy lawyers.
We've talked about doing a podcast for years.
We have.
Not for any particular reason, but it was like, well, everybody else has a podcast. We're funny. We should have one.
Yes, exactly. That was basically is the origin story is we're funny. Why not us?
But that is the thing that leads people so many places in their career is just asking yourself, why not me? Why not me? Why shouldn't I be a solo? Why shouldn't I have a podcast? Why shouldn't I do this? And we tossed around a number of ideas for so long, and OG listeners may remember this little nugget.
I know what you're going to say.
This is my original idea. I think we may have had a shared note or something where we were just keeping ideas. And we both love gardening, although I'm largely unable to do it at this point because of the out of control rabbit population in my neighborhood. But my original idea was like, what if we have a podcast and it's called Plant Queens and we talk about gardening? And JJ was like, girl, no.
I think you were like, we'll have a plant of the week.
We can have guests to talk about their plants. And JJ had the wisdom to be like, I love you, but no. And I know, I think we come by our interest in the subject matter, which for your listeners who have not listened to our podcast, we tell a story usually every week of a lawyer who has been disciplined or otherwise run into trouble because they've done something unethical. And we've covered everything from lawyers planting drugs on PTA volunteers to judges stealing money to buy Britney Spears tickets. Yeah, to people who didn't tell anybody that their client was dead as they were prosecuting litigation. And I mean, all kinds of just crazy, crazy nonsense. But we come by our interest in this very naturally, I think, as Bravo and entertainment, people who are interested in gossip. And I know I also have always been interested in not only legal ethics, but kind of what goes on in terms of decision making. How do we get to these places? Because these choices are, in my mind, just so absurd and plainly wrong. I like to think I would never find myself in the same boat. And so I think we both have an appreciation for the absurd and trying to dig into how do we get here?
Yeah. And I would add too that I think, I won't say every story because I can't talk in absolutes because they drill that out of you, but probably the vast majority of our stories, it's never just one wrong decision that our subject has made. It's one wrong decision that they then doubled down on or tripled down on or tried to cover up. And so that's what gets your interest is why, when, sure, everyone makes a mistake, but why then continue on with this waterfall of bad decisions? And add to that, it should probably be entertaining because we like to entertain each other. We go to lunch with our friends. We laugh like crazy. We cry. We laugh so hard at telling each other stories. And so we wanted our podcast to just have that same feeling and be that same experience.
And how has it grown or changed or morphed over the time you've been doing it? And has the goal changed? Has the way you prep changed? Has the audience changed? What's it been like?
I think, I mean, on the one hand, it hasn't changed. I think we, you know, still have the same types of stories at the very beginning. I think we were a little worried we ran out of content and then quickly realized that
Your podcast could be a daily podcast and you have plenty of content.
I don't think, I'll speak for myself, you know, because we each prep our episodes individually and then surprise tell the other person that, for me, my prep has not really changed that much. You know, we look to not only stories, but obviously we want primary sources. We want the pleadings, the briefing, the screenshots of the text, the things like that, that give you a much better story and you're able to tell something interesting. So my prep, I can't tell you how many really interesting sounding stories end up on the cutting room floor because there's just not enough there. And so it's a lot of work to try and even find a story that has enough there in terms of primary documents to sit, tell an interesting story for an hour, more or less, you know, to a friend.
I think we both also draw on the communication skills that we've had to necessarily develop both in litigation practices, but also in-house, because one of the, I think, main drivers of success in-house is your ability to communicate effectively and succinctly, which is not a skill that everybody has.
And to a non-legal audience as well.
Especially to a non-legal audience. And I think that's something that we've had to focus on for so long in our careers, and storytelling too, whether you're giving a board presentation and the story is sort of dry about risks to the company or whatever, or you're putting together some sort of pleading in litigation and you're trying to tell your story to the court or to the jury, you're thinking about the components of your story and how to communicate it effectively. And so I think we both draw on those skills when we are doing prep. And I tend to be fairly methodical about the way that I do my preparation. So I maintain all of my source documents. I mean, our podcast is not based on gossip that somebody emails us, as JJ alluded to. It is based on primary source documents that we read and dig into. And I maintain all of that fairly meticulously, in part because I want to be accurate and to be able to convey stories accurately. I find that to the extent our stories have been covered by other media, you're typically dealing with a non-legal journalist who may not have really dug into the primary source material. And there's a lot of rich material there for us. But I also am cognizant of the fact that we are telling stories about lawyers who may not be very happy that we are telling stories about them, even though we tend not to use people's real names. We usually call them Larry Lawyer, in part because our focus is on the story and not on the individual. And I want to be able to pull out my homework at the end of the day and say, your pleading said this, or your response said this, or here's what the deposition transcript said. So I tend to be fairly careful about all of that and to be organized about it, which is also driven just by the nature of my practice in that I have to be organized in my practice. And so in a way, I treat my approach to the podcast a bit like I treat my approach to my practice too.
We're broadcasting under our full God-given names. So, I mean, I want the stories I tell to be accurate and the representations I make to be accurate, not only because it's my name, but I mean, you can separate your podcast from your practice only so far. So we want to ensure that what we're saying is accurate and backed up with primary factual sources.
That was the follow-up I was going to ask, which is this hard to do while you're also practicing and either working with clients or working for a company like you do? Has there been any sort of questioning or stress about having an entertaining podcast that calls out lawyers for doing ridiculous things, but also having to be part of the profession where other lawyers need your services?
Well, JJ knows that I'm driven largely by anxiety. And so, of course, yes, there's been stress about it because I stress about everything and I'm anxious about everything. And I think, number one, this was a real experiment in authenticity for me because I have felt that I've spent a large part of my career in places where I didn't necessarily feel like I could be myself or my whole self. And there's a lot of pressure in the legal profession to censor yourself and to never say anything that could possibly offend a client. Mm-hmm. And of course, I don't mean extreme things, but there's just a lot of pressure to sort of, I don't know, make yourself
conform
or to be bland and or to really just be this sort of canvas that the client can paint on, because we're focused on clients, right? It's not about us, it's about them. And we don't want to do anything that could drive a client away. And I am at the point in my practice where I am completely fine if certain people don't want to work with me. That's okay. Not everybody is going to like me. I am not going to like everybody. And it's okay if we decide that we are not the appropriate fit. And I would be lying if I told you I wasn't nervous about getting onto a podcast and kind of just letting it rip. And we use profanity quite frequently on our podcast. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot to say about the situations we discuss and other things that are going on in the profession. And of course, it made me nervous, but I also felt like as I was leaning into my solo career, this is really the first time in my career that I felt able to be fully authentic, both in my practice and as it relates to this podcast as well. And so it was just an experiment in let's put it out there and see what happens.
Yes to all of that. And also, I would say that we're very methodical in the subjects we pick, and that we know, I trust that Karen will not pick something and talk to me about something that may infringe a current or former client's interests. Mm-hmm. And I would never do the same to her. We don't divulge confidential or client information in our podcasts either. And we would never put each other in the position of doing that. So I think there's a trust there too, over many, many years of friendship, where we know that that's not going to be an issue as well.
We've had some conversations too about, hey, I can't talk about this because X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And that's fine. That's what you have to do. Mm-hmm.
And what's the goal? Like, is it going to keep going? Are you finding value from it? Are you feeling enriched by it? I mean, I say this as somebody who's been doing podcasting now for 3 years, right? It's easy to start a podcast. It's really hard to keep one going. Where do you see the podcast going in the future?
Jonah, you're supposed to ask us how we monetize it, because that's the number one question everybody has. And we're always like, yes, we don't. It's a money pit. Yeah.
If you have an idea, let us know.
Yeah. Right,
well, no,
right.
We know what we would need to do. Yeah. But I think the goal is to keep going as long as it's fun and enjoyable for us, because this is really, really fun for us. And we really enjoyed developing kind of a community around the podcast as well. Mm-hmm. That's been an unanticipated benefit because like Jennifer suggested, we didn't necessarily think there would be that many episodes. And we also didn't necessarily think people would be interested in it. So it's been an added benefit to get to know our audience a little bit. And it is tricky to balance this with being parents of young kids and having robust legal practices and other interests in life. But this is kind of a hobby for me. This is one of my interests, and it's fun to be able to share that both with Jennifer and with other people.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, crazy stories come out, and half the time, the first thing I think is, oh my God, I can't wait to make Karen laugh about this.
I love that.
So it's you get to spend an hour and a half once a week or so chatting with one of your best friends. It's pretty fun. So it's, you know, we make each other laugh, and then the community, knowing that we're bringing some form of entertainment to obviously our friends, our community, people we care about. I mean, you know, it's a pretty cool feeling.
As far as what the goal is for the podcast or where we see it going, I think in the immediate future, this is breaking news, although perhaps not given when this might actually air, but we are in discussions right now about launching a Patreon, which for those who may not be familiar with it, is essentially subscription content for your listeners. And that's not something that would ever allow us to leave our day jobs. But again, it sounds fun and we'd like to do more of it. Mm-hmm. And we've also done a handful of speaking engagements this year and are in discussions related to speaking engagements next year as well, related to the podcast. And that's also fun. We enjoy doing that. We enjoy meeting people. So that's where I see it going for right now. I don't have any aspirations to be a full-time podcaster. I love my practice, but this is really fun.
I love that. And it's a good thing you didn't ask me to tell you how to monetize because I haven't figured that out either. I use I have the acronym LUSH everywhere, which is largely unpaid side hustle. And that's how I think about my podcast.
Yeah,
so I feel that to my core. And, you know, at the end of the day, it sounds like, I mean, just hearing the two of you talk with the joy about doing the podcast is what I try to tell people when they ask me, like, why do you spend all this time doing this? You're a busy person.
Sure.
You have a full-time job, right? You get to build connection to people you'd never build connection with. You get to have conversations you'd never have. And you get to do it where other people might get some benefit or a smile or anything else from it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I mean, and we get to be nosy and learn things. And, you know, that's just a side benefit.
Yeah, this gives me an excuse to be nosy on a weekly basis, which I love.
Exactly.
I love it. I love it. Well, look, we're coming close to the end of our time. So I always end by asking for a piece of advice that you'd give specifically to a more junior lawyer or someone just starting out in our profession. And I'll let you take that however you want. That could be based on your career. That could be based on some of the stories you've covered in your podcast, whatever you'd like. What's a piece of advice you'd leave those who are just getting started with?
I would say relationships are more important than you can imagine as a lawyer, and you never know where a relationship will lead. My first in-house role I got because it was my summer associate mentor when I summered, had gone in-house, and we'd stayed in touch over Facebook for 6 years, and he reached out because we had stayed Facebook friends. And that's how I got my role. And every other role I've gotten in-house has been a result of relationships or friendships or friends of friends that I've had. So be open to making connections, help others make connections, because you never know how that's going to, one, because it's the right thing to do, and two, because you never know how that's going to pay off in the future.
Related to being the co-host of a podcast about lawyers doing bad things, flex that ethical muscle and think about what your boundaries are and what you are going to do if somebody pushes on those boundaries, because it will happen in your career. And I think in certain practices, it happens more frequently than others. But you have to be kind of prepared to respond to that and also to experience the discomfort of being ethical. Because the reason we have ethical rules in part is because sometimes it's not easy to be ethical. It would be way easier for us to make the unethical choice that enriches us at our client's expense or some other sort of inappropriate behavior that might be kind of temporarily gratifying to us. And I think Jennifer referenced the fact that in a lot of the stories we tell, it's never just a single bad decision. It's a cascade of bad decisions. And if somebody had bitten the proverbial bullet at the first exit point and said, I am going to experience some temporary embarrassment, setback in my career, maybe humiliation, but I am going to acknowledge that I've done the wrong thing and work to correct it, they might not be on our podcast.
Yeah.
That takes practice, you know, and it is very uncomfortable sometimes to push back on somebody who's pressuring you, whether it's a client or it's a partner or it's a coworker, whoever. That's not an easy spot to be in. And so the more that you think about it and sort of prepare yourself for the fact that that may be coming for you, the more you set yourself up to navigate that successfully and in a way that is best for you and your career and limits damage to yourself and everybody else.
Absolutely. Well, look, thanks to both of you for doing this and for just being authentic people. It is so hard, I think, in the legal profession, as you said, to be your full self. And the two of you, from everything I've seen, are willing to do it and do it publicly. And I just think that is such a, frankly, it's inspiring. I think it's awesome. And you're funny too, which makes it that much more fun. Where can people find the podcast or you all if they're interested in, if they haven't started listening and they don't mind a little extra profanity compared to How I Lawyer?
Well, Jonah, after that, when can we come back? I'm ready to be a guest again tomorrow.
Anytime. We'll make it happen. As long as you don't make me be funny on your podcast, I'm happy to keep this going because you guys are awesome. This is so fun.
But Lawyers Behaving Badly is available wherever you get your podcasts. We are on social media at Bad Lawyer Pod. And you can also, if you have tips for us, you can reach us at badlawyerpod@gmail.com. We love tips.
We love tips.
And on that inspiring note, please go listen. And I hope you enjoyed hearing from my two guests today. And most of all, just thanks for being here. And thanks for being part of this little mini community we're building across the country of lawyers with day job or lush podcasters, largely unpaid side hustle podcasters. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Jonah.
Thanks, Jonah.
Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or at Jonah Perlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening and have a great week.